We've scoured the web to bring you some of the most interesting stories about parenting, relationships, and mental health, including, were our ancestors smarter than us, why expressing anger can be a bad thing, and the impact of starting school young. Get the latest news this week on Family Anatomy.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologist.
So if you need to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you could get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spizzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. You can find us at familyanatomy.com or over on iTunes, and it's just us in the studio today once again. We're talking about some news stories today. It's been a long time since we did a Three Things episode.
I guess it has been, although it took me a while to find my notes for this one because I had all these top three things notes in different files and I kept pulling up the wrong one.
I feel like, and I might be wrong, maybe I'm misremembering, but I feel like the last time we did this were the first two episodes of the new year when we talked about the top three stories of 2012, parenting stories and relationship stories.
I think you were right. That's the ones that I saw earlier today when I was fishing.
Well, there you go. And here I was just guessing. But in fact, I was absolutely correct.
Well, there's always firsts, eh?
Hey now.
It's not good. Podcast and life in general.
Yes. Let's not get crazy here. All right. So one of the stories we're going to talk about today was a little something from a journal called Intelligence. You've never read that journal before, I can tell.
Well... I was going to say that the article is called Were the Victorians Cleverer Than Us?
And, cleverer.
And I thought to myself, they have to be specific. They're cleverer than you.
Wait, what?
Right?
Yeah,
but not everyone.
Sherlock Holmes is much cleverer than most other people I could name.
So this is a May 2013 study.
Well, I think it's not even, is it even published? Is it? It's online as of May 2013, but I'm not, did it make it in the journal yet? I thought it was in press.
Right. I think it's in press.
But it's really hot off the presses.
Yes, and not quite. So the decline in general intelligence estimated from a meta-analysis of the slowing of simple reaction time is the subtitle.
Wow, that is a long title.
Yes, it's pretty much nothing to everybody except for us, perhaps.
That's right. Well, we always like to read about meta-analyses, which is examining the results of multiple studies and trying to put them together to see what the overall finding is.
Study of studies.
That's why it's meta. Mm-hmm.
So what did they do here?
Well, before we get to what did they do, right, there's a couple of things that they're talking about. One thing that we studied in probably introduction to psychology years ago was a little thing called the Flynn effect, which was all about how intelligence is increasing over time because of improvements in education and improvements in nutrition and exposure to cognitive complexity.
That's right. Yeah. So they've measured, this is about over the last 50 years or so, Flynn effect. And they're showing that about for every decade, there's about a 1.3 point increase in IQ. So that over time, it's a significant thing over 50 years.
People are getting smarter. And so I saw this title and thought
that.
It's the
opposite. Yeah, they're telling us that now perhaps it's the opposite.
I thought it was opposite day. Maybe I checked to see if April 1st was the publication date of this study, but it was not.
It was not. It was not an April Fool's thing.
It was not an April Fool's thing at all. And so what they've done is, it's funny, right? Because intelligence tests are a relatively new phenomenon and they do change over time, but people have been measuring for hundreds of years reaction time. You see something and they time how long it takes you to respond to it.
And because that's the only data they had that went back that long was data on reaction time, which is a very, when they call it simple reaction time.
Right.
Because there's more complex reaction time measures as well.
Mm-hmm.
So because that's the only thing that went back to, what is it,
1884. Yeah, they looked at studies from 1884 to 2004.
That's right. So that's the only thing. So if they would have had our modern-day intelligence test back then, they wouldn't have used just a simple reaction time. Although they're trying to tell us in this study, well, before we get to that, let's just see what they showed first. Let's not criticize right away.
They took a look at, and they were careful at how they chose their studies. They took a look at 14 studies that looked at reaction time that didn't require too much movement. It was basically see something and respond to it right away. You didn't have to reach for anything or raise your hand or things like that.
They weren't necessarily big studies. Some were as low as 20 people.
From 1884 all the way up to 2004, that was just looking at how long it would take someone to press a button, for example, when they saw something.
That's right. So, you know, this is something that we do, except it's not exactly like the kind of thing they would have done in the 1800s, late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
We do something that's more like a complex visual reaction time. We don't do the simple one. The simple one, I looked it up online because we don't do it and haven't seen it. So, you know, here's an example of how they're saying they've measured simple reaction time.
Right.
Right. So you've got the screen in front of you,
mm-hmm.
and the screen is white.
Right.
And you touch start on the screen, and the screen turns green, and as soon as it turns green, you have to hit the stop button on the screen. So there's your reaction time.
Simple
in
reaction
seconds.
Time. Yep.
Now, the reaction time back in 1884, when this started, they didn't have this kind of thing. So it was like a string
and
with
Scotch
a ball
tape,
on the end. It was a metronome of some kind,
right,
that measured. So you didn't have these milliseconds.
Right.
Right, the same way you could have it. So there's a thing about accuracy and how they're measuring it. But anyways, what they found was, what did they find?
Well, they found that over time, reaction time has slowed. And in fact, each decade, I think it slowed by 1.23, well, points, they call them, because they do a big conversion on all of this. Basically, they've found a way to equate simple reaction time to a general cognitive ability, right? G, Spearman's G, which is thought of as general intelligence. And reaction time is correlated. Reaction time is related to general intelligence. If you process information more quickly, you're going to have faster reaction time. And so they've done some mathematical calculations in order to estimate that each decade, intelligence has declined by 1.23 points for a total of about 14 points since the 1800s.
Since the Victorians. Right, so here's the thing.
Which is a significant amount.
It is a significant amount, and they're not saying that the Flynn effect is not also true, that intelligence has gone up over time.
Right.
I think basically what's happening here is they're saying, yes, intelligence has gone up over time as well, but there's this undercurrent, this almost countervailing force to that increase, which is a decrease that's masked by the Flynn effect.
That's
by
right.
An increase. And I think, you know, the way I'm reading it is that, you know, because if you look at the Flynn effect, it's only last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
So they're using more modern measures of intelligence that we use today.
Right, right.
They're not exactly the same, but they're more on the same line.
Well, it could be tests by the same publishers.
It could
be
the Wechsler
over the past 50 years, or the Stanford Binet.
That's right. So as opposed to this other sort of visual reaction test, which is a kind of a sliver. You know,
right.
If actually look at,
and it did require them to do some fancy math in order to convert everything.
They did. Now, so now here, let's get to why they think this is happening.
Okay,
because this is kind of funny,
right?
I mean,
there's a few reasons why. Yeah.
Well, the main reason that they're looking at though is a little funny, because it's actually there's a comedy about this,
right,
that we've seen prior to seeing the study, and it's a joke,
right?
And here they're trying to prove the joke from this comedy that we've seen.
Sort of, yeah,
right,
yeah. They didn't even mention the movie
they
called...
They didn't mention the movie, but that's exactly the thesis of the movie, but yeah. It's a joke. In this one, they're saying that people with less education, right?
Right.
Are more likely to have more children, and it's also correlated with lower IQs, whereas people with higher education have fewer children. So given right. the Darwinian...
Yeah, there are ideas that people who have, are...
I think generally in this journal, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's like... there's articles about some of the more controversial figures in intelligence in this journal. Like right. there's a bit of a political agenda in this journal, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, so that's what they're saying.
There's so yeah, one of the
very
things
controversial
is,
thing
one of
say.
The things is the idea that people are waiting, right? For example, people who are going further in school are waiting to have kids. They're having fewer kids, and I mean, I'm one of six, and I have two kids. I went to school for a long time, and we put it off. We put off having kids.
Right, but they're saying
so
that
anecdotally
that's related to intelligence. That's a different story. The you know the idea that. Well, if you're more educated, you have fewer kids is true.
Right. Yeah.
But they're saying that that's related to the decline in intelligence.
Well,
because
it might be, yeah.
Right? Because
people the people who are going to school for that many years might be.
And,
yeah. Well, right? That's what. And the other thing, though, there is another possible explanation that they mentioned. And the one that you're talking about, the idea that people with lower education and lower IQs are having more kids, is the one that the newspapers picked up on. Like every newspaper story was like, relating it back to that Mike Judge
as
movie.
Well, but
they mentioned that. And even in the study, they kind of discounted the neurotoxin idea yeah. because of the way that they did their math. Somehow they managed to discount that. But they also noted that improvements in medical technology have allowed people who have slower reaction times, who might not otherwise have survived long enough to do these tests, would result in an overall decline just because, you know, more people with a wider range of skills who maybe wouldn't have gone in for research like this are able to do so.
That's right. Now, here's the other thing about this study. This idea that simple reaction time is a great measure of someone's intelligence
right.
is a bit of a stretch. What I found is that when you look at the complex visual test, mm-hmm. reaction test, it accounts for about 20 to 25% of the variance in intelligence.
Right.
That's the complex one.
Yep.
That's the one we're using.
Yep.
This is the simple one.
And they're
this
saying,
is even less than 20%.
Oh, they say it's much more than that, right?
There's other psychologists that have
you're not
at
wrong.
This.
It's a bit of a stretch. And the fact is, when you look at their graph of the scatter of results on these different studies, I mean, they've drawn a line in the middle, but there's quite a bit of scatter between the studies for, well, these 14 studies. It's sort of, when you just look at the graph without their regression line with the math that they've done to do the calculation to average everything out, it just looks like a bunch of dots all over the place. Those 14 data points don't appear when you're just eyeballing them. And even they admit this at the end of the study, they don't appear to follow that pattern.
That's true. The other thing is that, you know, we do intelligence tests all the time. We do the modern intelligence tests all the time.
All the time.
If we were using just even the complex visual reaction time test that we use
right.
to measure intelligence alone, that would be outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, absolutely outrageous. The comprehension factors on the modern intelligence tests yeah. that we use.
The problem-solving part.
Those are the ones that really give right. you a sense of how well someone understands the world around them, not how quickly. See, the reaction time stuff, the answers are already on the page or they're on the screen in front of you.
Yeah.
You don't have to figure anything out.
You
don't
have to think about it.
You don't have to comprehend anything.
It's neural transmission.
It's like an open book test.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's just speed. There's people who have very quick thinking, but they don't comprehend.
Well, and it's not quick decision making. It's just press a button. Right? Because it's like you said,
simple
reaction time.
That's it.
Right? It's not even like the Stroop test or anything like that. We'll leave it for our listeners to Google the Stroop test. And we could talk about our next story.
All right. So our next story is from the American Journal of Cardiology.
Oh, yes.
From researchers at Harvard Medical School.
Another study that's in press. Hot, not yet on the presses.
That's right. So they looked at around 4,000 heart attack patients between 1989 and 1996.
In a study called Relation of Outbursts of Anger and Risk of Acute Myocardial Infarction by Mustofsky.
Just give everybody a chance to get a pencil and write that down.
I'll tell you what, I had to read that title. And the reason why I had to read that title is that medical journals, man, are painful. It's written in such a different way from the studies that you and I usually read, either for the show or just for our work, that I had to read it like three times.
I know. It's really, when you start to look at the figures, especially like,
yeah,
you know.
Oh, and they abbreviate everything. And you have to go back and check, okay, that's AMI is acute myocardial infarction and et cetera, et cetera.
It's all the acronyms, right?
All those acronyms that get you every time.
So what do? They study these almost 4,000 heart attack patients and they ask them to recall events over the past year.
Mm-hmm.
Their diet, their exercise, their medication use. But the thing that was most important for this study was episodes of anger.
Yep. Yeah, and they specifically asked about anger outburst relatively recently prior to their acute myocardial infarction or their heart attack.
Within the past 2 hours, within 2 hours preceding the heart attack.
Right.
Right? So they're looking just at the 2 hours preceding
mm-hmm.
to see if there's any correlation between the anger episode that they had and their heart attack
and
risk.
That's a correlation that has been found in prior research.
That's right.
So it's not a brand new thing. They were kind of confirming, I guess, previous results or attempting to confirm previous results by the study.
And so they had a 7-point scale.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the low part of that was irritation and the top was like a total rage.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they found that was different was that there's a dose effect, I guess. Yes, they did find that angry outbursts can increase the risk of a heart attack by, I think they said, twofold or even a little bit more than twofold.
I think it's like at the bottom end of the scale, it was a little less than twofold, and mm-hmm. at the top end was a little more than fourfold.
Right, exactly.
Times.
So they said overall, it's probably more than twofold. And there was a dose effect, meaning that the angrier, the bigger the angry outburst, the higher the risk.
That's right. That's right.
So, and that's something that hadn't been found previously. That was their new finding.
And that's the most impressive part of the study, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you start to look at the numbers, you start to wonder because they're looking at close to 4,000 people.
Yeah. So it's a big study.
It is. But now out of those 4,000, about 1,500 actually reported having angry episodes in the past year. I don't know mm-hmm. what these other people, they have bad memories. They don't get angry. I don't understand that. So that's a little funny.
Yep.
But so 1,500 people reported anger episodes in the past year. And out of those 1,500, only 110 had heart attacks following within the 2 hours.
Right,
preceding the heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only 110 people there. True. So out of those 110
mm-hmm.
is where you see that. And like I said, that's the most interesting thing about the study.
Yeah.
If it was just that these 110, regardless of their level of anger,
uh-huh.
were getting heart attacks, it's not that impressive.
Well, it would be the same as the previous studies that have been done, right?
Well, maybe not even because you're looking at 1,500 people who had anger and it wasn't related to
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
to the heart attack, at least immediately, because you're assuming because it occurred within 2 hours, it's
right.
related.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So it's the fact that they could say a little bit of anger twice
increases the
as
risk
much,
a little bit.
A
yeah.
lot of anger within yeah. that 2 hours is four times as much. That's the impressive part.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly, those 4,000 people, most of them didn't report anger. The ones that did, the vast majority of them didn't have a heart attack within 2 hours.
So manage your anger, in other words.
Well, that's the other interesting thing, right? So they say...
They're talking about angry outbursts, of course.
Right, and they're saying that catharsis... Well, we've talked about this before.
Catharsis, meaning...
Getting that anger out. Oh, you're bottling it in. You have to get it out. It makes mm-hmm. you feel better. It's
right.
better for your health.
Yeah,
to
so
get it out.
Yell when you're mad at someone.
Yes, or punch something and this kind of thing.
Right.
Right.
Well, and the reason why we've been talking about the the notion that punching a pillow and things like that aren't a good idea is that the research shows that that sort of primes the pump for an aggressive reaction when someone, when a child is angry, right? Is that you're kind of training yourself to react in that angry way as opposed to trying to learn to express your anger in a way that's more appropriate.
That's right. You know, that's it. You're practicing.
Right.
Right. You're basically practicing. Yeah.
And but, practice, you know, makes perfect.
That's right. So they're saying that but the angry outburst, they're saying that that releases hormones into your bloodstream,
yeah,
cortisol,
yep,
and norepinephrine. Mm-hmm. And with that, it increases your blood pressure, it constricts your blood vessels, yep, it does damage to your cardiovascular system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it's related to heart attacks.
Well, there's still a problem, though, with this idea, is that what they're doing is they're asking people retrospectively, oh, so you've had a heart attack. What happened just before your heart attack? You know, and what are you going to do? Your brain will sort of find those patterns, whether or not the patterns, now I'm not saying the pattern's not there, mm-hmm, right? Because other research has shown that those angry outbursts are linked. So there is a link there. But when you're talking about a retrospective study, I mean, people overestimate those connections for sure. I mean,
well, they distort them in every way.
Absolutely. There's like, can you remember what you had for supper 2 weeks ago? They're asking people, did you get angry 2 hours before your heart attack? When was the heart attack?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. But then that's, like I say, there's the other thing. Like 2,500 people in, mm-hmm, this study,
mm-hmm,
didn't get angry this past year.
Yeah.
So it's distorted in every way.
They're not reporting.
That's,
yeah,
impossible, really. Yeah.
So it's a strange pattern. But, I mean, what do the headlines say? Expressing anger leads to a heart attack.
Yeah.
Right? That's what the newspapers will tell you.
That's right.
Every single time.
And now, there's, like, they make sense in the way they're describing what likely could be happening, though.
Right.
When you're doing that with your anger. And I guess there's also, I mean, I didn't look this up, but I know from previous research,
right,
they've looked at bottling feelings.
Sure. Yeah.
Too,
yeah. Yep.
Not being a healthy, mm-hmm, thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I feel like the headline really should be for this, right? Not now. It would be a combination of other studies to really wrap this thing up.
Right.
It's not whether you're holding it in or you're expressing the anger.
Right.
It's how you're dealing with it. Are you dealing with it in an assertive way that you can be proud of, or that you feel, mm-hmm, that something's being resolved at least within yourself?
Right.
Or is it brewing inside, or, you know, attacking another person, which just makes your life more complicated and miserable.
Indeed it does.
And so this is really what they should be talking about.
That's however, true. But what do they talk about? If you take aspirin or beta blockers, it really helps to reduce the link between anger and heart attacks. So don't change anything you're doing. Just take these pills.
Take the pills.
Welcome to a medical journal. Well, you ask a medical doctor, you will get a medical solution.
What do you want?
Right. Exactly. But they did mention exercise, which I mean, it's nice that they talked about exercise.
That's right.
They didn't talk about appropriate expressions of anger, though.
No.
That's what psychologists like to right. see, right?
That's up to us. They should have invited us in on that research.
I wish they would. Hmm. No, I don't have time to do research. I barely have time to read the research, for crying out loud.
I wouldn't mind going to Harvard for a while.
Well, we could go visit Boston. Yeah. We could write it off. All right. So our next study is one that's a little bit different. It's a local one. So for the past several years, the provincial government has been administering these standardized tests every few grades, grade 3, grade 6, grade 9, and then there's a literacy test that kids have to pass before they can graduate. And usually they take that in grade 10. And so they've got all of this information, all of these data points from kids all over the province, and they're beginning to publish some analysis of what's going on with these kids, and this information is available online.
That's right. So it's called the Education Quality and Accountability Office, EQAO. It basically has to do with standardized tests that they think they must have instituted them around 2005, because the study starts then,
mm-hmm,
in 2005 with a sample of 7,200 English language students who began kindergarten between 2005 and 2008.
Right. And one of the things that they do is they collect information in kindergarten. It's not a standardized test, but they collect some data on, well, they call it readiness, you know, is a child ready, basically ready for school, ready to learn. So they get a little bit of information about where what the starting point is, and then they try to use some of that information to predict where academic outcomes are going to go.
That's right. So, and this is the kind of interesting thing that I found, like in kindergarten, 56% of kids are considered to be on track by teachers who were surveyed.
Mm-hmm.
And 44% of kids were considered not to be on track. That's a pretty high number. 44, of kids
almost half.
For teachers to feel are not where they should be.
Right.
Given that they are where they should be. Right? Because they're developing.
Yeah, they're still developing. Yeah.
That's almost half that they're saying are not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably 56% of the students are girls and 44% are boys. It's probably maybe there's a link there. I don't know. We didn't look at that.
We did not. No.
We did not look at that. But so what they have, though, are, well, reams of information that's predictive, right? This is not
reading, writing, and math.
In reading, writing, and math. So it's not a retrospective study, really. It's a prospective study so they can look at what are the connections that lead to academic success. How can we predict this? And one of the things that is pretty self-evident, and you would think they wouldn't even need to really talk about it, but guess what? Absenteeism, kids who don't show up at school very often, that's something that predicts some problems down the road. But what I thought was interesting about it is that a pattern of absenteeism is evident as early as kindergarten, and it continues.
Well, you know, I don't know how many times I've looked through school files where, you know, a parent is presenting, say, at the high school level. You know, so we haven't seen this particular child before.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look back in their history, the presenting problem in grade 9, which is they're not coming to school. How do we get them to school?
Yeah.
If you look back, there's a long history of this. And you know, I always warn parents when I see their kids in the earlier elementary grades that they're starting to miss school.
Mm-hmm.
I say, I've seen this, you know.
Yeah.
When they're getting used to missing this much time for little tummy aches, for little headaches,
right,
this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Once they get into their teen years where your control over them is diminished so greatly. Okay.
They can sign themselves out. Yeah.
If you had a hard time getting to school when they're in grade 2, what's going to happen when they're in grade 9 and 10?
Right.
I mean,
it's not going to go away.
It's not. It's only going to get worse.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. The situation definitely gets worse. And it's so interesting to see it borne out that the pattern begins at such an early age. And it's good for parents to be aware of that, so that they can find ways, and often they can work together with the school to help make the situation better. It doesn't have to be something where the parent is just pushing the child out the door, right? Because you don't want, if a child is anxious or if they're having problems, maybe they're having some learning difficulty that's making it hard for them or frustrating for them, or bullying or what have you. There could be any number of things that might make a child reluctant to attend. But
what the parent is seeing is these little tummy aches and these little headaches.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so the parent sees that, and maybe they think the child's ill or there's a bit of a flu, or, you know, well, they can't go if they're sick. They don't want to spread, you know, you don't want to spread things to other people. And then, like you said, it winds up being a pattern, and partly because the source of the difficulty doesn't get addressed unless you do some investigation and you try and work on the problem somehow. I think that information like this, well, hopefully we'll give parents an idea that attendance at school is something if there's a problem, that they should prioritize working on that problem and trying to figure out more about what's going on.
No doubt. Now, the other thing that they looked at with this research data that they had is the difference between kids who were born early in the year, I think it's January to March, versus later in the year, October to December.
That for me was, you know, there are other findings about a gender gap that's starting to narrow, and about changing schools, which might be worth talking about. But the most interesting thing is this idea that kids who start school at a younger age are having their academic progress is different from the kids who are older when they begin attending, who had that January birthday and got to start late.
Now, this is personal for me because I have a child who was born in December.
Oh.
He's the tiniest, the youngest in his class.
Right, right.
So I was curious to see what this said. So what they're saying is that in grade 3,
mm-hmm,
8 to 10% more kids in the older group, the kids who were born January to March,
right,
reach the provincial standard in reading, writing, and math. More of those kids reach the standard than the younger kids.
Right.
In the grade 6 follow-up tests, mm-hmm, for reading, writing, and math, it diminished. It was 7 to 8% more kids in the older group than the younger group reached the provincial standard.
But that's not a huge change. That's a pretty stable difference, right?
No, no, no. But then you get to the grade 9 math. There was no difference between the two groups for math.
Yep.
And then for language arts, what happened there was that the older group was 85% successful, while the younger group was 81% successful.
Right.
And so 4 points difference now.
That's right. So
you get to grade 10.
It looks like that gap.
Nothing for math.
It looks like that gap.
Diminishing gap, right? Yeah,
it looks like that gap does diminish over time, although there has been other research that shows that it persists. And one of the reasons why the ministry or the authors of this paper suggested that the high school situation might be so different, whereas in some other provinces you find that the gap remains even at the high school level, is that by the time students get to high school, they might be following a different pathway in terms of their math. So you have applied math and you have academic math. And so the kids who are struggling are more likely to go to the applied stream versus the academic stream. And they found a difference in the proportion of younger kids in the applied level versus the academic level, where there were more of the older kids.
That's right. But then you have to look at the differences here. Mm-hmm. So if in language arts, reading and writing.
Sure.
Right? If in reading and writing, there's 81% versus 81% of the younger group versus 85% of the older group, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So that means that the vast majority
of the
younger group,
in both
as well
cases,
as the other group,
yep.
are getting through.
They're doing fine.
It's, you know what I'm saying? So the article could be called Achievement Gap Between Older and Younger Kindergarten Students Diminishes Significantly by the Time Kids Get to High School. I mean, it could just as easily have been called that. And most studies prior to this showed that it either disappeared or diminished.
Right, right. And this one continues that trend, although there's that bit of self-selection in terms of which pathway kids are taking in the math area. So it's certainly an interesting finding, and it could, I mean, we've talked before about the idea that kids need to start school when they're developmentally ready, right? That presenting reading and math and things like that before kids are developmentally ready can set up a situation where they feel disengaged from school, where they feel like their teachers don't understand them or don't care about them, where they just feel like they're not good at learning. And that can create a pattern that's problematic. Now, that's more on an individual basis than a group study like the one that we're talking about here. Transitions between schools is an important one too, though, because kids who have recently started at a new school also have some struggles in terms of their academic performance. And that, I mean, that makes sense based on the transitional stress of starting, you know, making new friends and getting used to new teachers and a new teaching style and a whole new learning environment. It certainly speaks to the importance of transition planning, right? Making sure that kids are, if there's a student who's having some trouble, that he's well supported when he starts in his new educational building.
Well, yeah, you need some sort of antidote to that stress that happens, because the stress does is it sets you off track.
Yeah.
You have other fish to fry besides, you know, reading and writing and math when you're changing perhaps homes, you're changing schools, you're changing classmates, you're changing teachers.
That's a stressful situation.
It's so stressful. Yeah. If the school can help that transition along.
Right.
And we always talk about the relationships being one of the more important parts of that, which I think get neglected sometimes. You know, we put other structures into place.
We do.
For transitions,
we do.
But we don't think about the relationships and how they can be somehow transferred from the previous school to this one, even with them, the kids seeing the old teachers, even for a short while with their new teachers.
Even just a little visit ahead of time to sort of meet who some of the people are in the building, meet the principal perhaps, you know, get a little bit of one-on-one with the principal, can smile and say, hey, I'm looking forward to having you. So they feel like they're welcome and they can get started on the right foot, right? That's part of the problem with that transitional stress, that a child who's starting at a new school could be stressed out or worried about it. And, you know, first impressions can last for a while, and especially if they're transferring mid-year and already some of the groups have formed, it's a difficult situation for kids. And anything that parents and teachers can do to make that easier is going to help the kids to be more successful.
And of course, there's other things that go into that, like, you know, their individual education plan might be part of that, that mm-hmm. you know, whatever level the child is working at, that information is transferred to the new school. Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of things their strengths, their needs, the kind of things that teachers can look out for in terms of, you know, what to take advantage of or what they're going to need extra help in, this kind of thing. But that's the real sense of belonging in this new place where they're going to be doesn't come from those things. It comes from the relationships that either do or don't get formed mm-hmm. in the new place.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it's true when kids are moving to a different neighborhood. It's true when they're making the transition from grade 6 to grade 7.
Now, that's funny that you say that. This is a little off topic.
Okay? Oh.
A little off topic, but just as you said that, I had this image flash in my head. When I was 10 years old, I moved from a neighborhood just down the street here
right.
to a West End neighborhood. And my very, very first day in my new home in my West End neighborhood when I was 10 years old,
right.
about 6 or 7 kids rushed up the street to greet me in my driveway and said, "Do you want to play?"
Wow.
Like that. Mm-hmm. The first day.
So you felt like, what a great neighborhood. It was going to be fun.
I didn't want to move from my old neighborhood.
Well, of course not.
But, you know, I transitioned so quickly after that. It was so easy. Look, you belong here and we're welcoming you here. The very first thing.
Right.
And it makes such a difference.
It absolutely does. You know, my son is transitioning to the intermediate level. He's going from an elementary school that goes up to grade 6 and he's starting grade 7. In the fall. And so he's had his tour of the school and he's met who the principal is and he's met the vice principal. And so he knows those guys a little bit and they're both, I mean, he's lucky enough that he's got some super friendly administrative staff in his new school building. So he certainly feels welcomed by them. And we did the tour as parents. We went along to do the tour, right? We wanted to make sure he went. A lot of his friends said, "I'm not going to go to that. That's not cool." But, I mean, we're thinking ahead and saying, well, we want him to feel as comfortable as possible. Yeah. So let's at least get in there and get the lay of the land and make sure that he sees that we care about who his teachers are and what things are going to be like there. So we're going wandering through this place a little bit, just my wife and I and our son. And we walked by this one room and he saw what was inside and was beside himself with excitement about, what do you mean we get to use equipment like this at the school, and the teachers are there talking to him about it. And he just felt like this is going to be the perfect place for me. And they gave him all of this information. He thought this is going to be way better than elementary school. So he's very much, he went from being a little bit apprehensive about starting at a new school that's bigger and all the, and he's going to be with the bigger kids. They call them high schools. They don't call them high school students. They always call them high schools, those high schools. And so he went from being a bit apprehensive and a little bit nervous about it to being very excited about it, which is guaranteed, even though he's probably still going to be a bit nervous, you know, Labor Day weekend just before school starts. But guaranteed that transition is going to be so much easier for him just because he saw some things that he liked and some people reached out to him and said, you know, this is a great place to be and we can't wait for you to come here.
No doubt. No doubt. I mean, it's a perfect example right there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, well, and I think that brings us to the end.
So that's it for us for today. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter and Google+. And if you're listening on your iPhone or iPod or iPad, you can find us on the podcast app. As usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, and he's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
See you in 2 weeks. Get up and sing. It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do. FamilyAnatomy.com